This evening, we're in week 8 on this Reflections, talking about servant, in particular the servant of the Lord or the servant of God. But when we think about servants, generally, what do we think about? What are some of the ideas or some of the things that come to your mind when you think about servant?
Legal slavery.
Okay, legal slavery. Sometimes that's the case. Depending on your boss, I guess. Yes, Jim. Somebody that waits on you. Okay. You mean as in doing things for you? Because, you know. That's right. Yes, Hazel? Food servers. Okay. Well, I thought maybe he was talking about waiting on Cindy. What are some of the strengths that you find in people around you? Moving away from the word servant for a moment, what are some of the strengths that you find in people around you? Okay, we'll go more specifically. Are there people around you in which you find strengths that point towards servanthood? And what are some of those strengths? Some of those things that it takes to be, to relate to being a servant. Okay, faithful. Patience. Okay, honest. Right. What'd you say again, Jerry? Dependable, yeah. That's right, Ed. Others. Okay, willing. Willing. You know, probably more people in the world want to be served than want to serve, right? Because it costs something if you're going to serve. And that generally, faithfulness, commitment, dependability, all kinds of other things that it costs if we are going to serve rather than be served. Although, depending on the restaurant, I guess it could cost you to be served a good bit. So what about the costs of caring? What are some of the costs of caring? What's involved in caring and being a servant? Time? Okay. Sacrifice to please someone else first. Put someone before you. Okay. Resources. Physical, monetary, even emotional, mental resources. Can be taxing as well. Self-giving commitment, I guess, is kind of contains several of those things. A self-giving commitment, willingness to give of self rather than to be given to. So when we start thinking then of servant and serving, and we start thinking of the servant of the Lord, what are some of the things that come to mind? The servant of the Lord or the servant of God? I guess it depends in some parts whether we're looking at Old Testament or New Testament or intertestamental period. Okay, sacrifice. Sacrifice. Absolutely. Other things that might, when you think of the servant or servant of the Lord. Okay, helping the poor, helping other people. And even though Jesus places an emphasis on the poor, and God in the Old Testament places a tremendous emphasis on the poor, Jesus didn't just come for the poor, but the poor are the ones that were most accepting of Jesus. Okay, giving up the easiest for what is the right way to go. Well, oftentimes that does happen, even if it's somebody on a street corner. Well, the classic biblical description of servant we find in Isaiah. And that is transferred over in the New Testament. The New Testament writers understand that of Jesus. But among the passages that you read this week are Isaiah 53 and then Luke chapter 9. The focal point or passage in Luke 9 is verses 23 to 25. Giving up self-hating father and mother. Those kinds of things. Losing one's self. Gaining one's psyche or soul is the traditional word we use. In Isaiah, we have that classical suffering servant. Especially in Isaiah 40 to 55, but in 53, we have some key passages or some key understandings of that suffering servant and what that involves in Isaiah 53. In the New Testament, Jesus, of course, is the servant, and that Galilean, that one person, Jesus, takes upon himself that description of this suffering servant found in Isaiah. And in Isaiah 53, 1 to 12, we find those descriptions that very closely resemble or are identified with Jesus himself in the New Testament. But we also find that Jesus refers to servants. And he generally refers to them as doulos, which is slave. Another word that means servant is diakonos, but it's most often translated minister or deacon, sometimes servant. But doulos or slave is the word that's mostly used in the New Testament, which means that one is completely in the service of another. In fact, if one is the slave of another, a master, they only have one freedom. What would that freedom be? The freedom to choose to obey. That's the only freedom they have. In that classical understanding of doulos in Greek, slave, the only freedom is the freedom to obey. In the Hebrew, the word, there are a lot of different words, but a frequently used word is yebed, which means servant, but most of the time means is translated as slave. Very much like doulos in Greek in the New Testament. Yes? You can, not always involuntary, you can choose to be a slave, a doulos. It's not always involuntary. Mm-hmm. But in that sense, while you are that doulos, that slave, if it is voluntary, you are agreeing during that time to give up all rights to choose anything other than to obey. However, in the New Testament, even in the whole idea of yebed in the Hebrew, the idea is that while you are completely in the service of another, to treat the servant or the slave unjustly was a sin. They still retain the rights of being treated as a human being. So to treat them unjustly was a sin. Now, if they did something that deserved punishment, that's another matter. But to unjustly treat them just because they're your slave was considered a sin against them and a sin against God. If you look at the Deuteronomic law, the slave or the servant had rights. They had rights. And they retained a sense of dignity. They were not to be treated just as a piece of property to be thrown away on a whim or to be used to make fun of, to make sport of. In part, we will find, if you look in Deuteronomy, it says, because you too were once slaves, Israel. And yet God rescued them, retained that sense. Interestingly enough, when we get to the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, the word which is associated with the servant of God is therapo. Therapo carries the idea of being healed. And so the servant of God was one who voluntarily or who committed himself or herself to God, and in the process of obeying God, they found healing. So being the slave of the servant didn't necessarily mean destruction. But in the case of in the New Testament, Septuagint, in the case of the servant of the Lord or the servant of God, the idea is if you serve God willingly and gladly, then God will bring healing to you. That voluntary servitude, that voluntary doulos, or slavery. It could be any. Interestingly enough, the word psuche, that we often most often translate soul, is not, and sometimes psyche, but it really means the entire person. It's not just the metal. It's not just some ethereal divine spark. When one's whole soul is healed, that's physical, emotional, spiritual, all rolled into one. It's not just the psyche. It's not just that which we call soul, even though the most archaic translation is typically soul. But it means the entire person, this psyche. And the entire person is to be treated with dignity. While persons doing service had masters, they were to be treated well and not abused, just for the sake of abuse. Now, we do find in the New Testament as well that Paul will write about slavery and being slaves or servants, and he says, if your master mistreats you, don't lash out, don't go back. I mean, what good is it if you are rewarded for doing right? You expect that. He also says it of the state, the kings and the emperors. If you're mistreated because you do something poorly, you deserve it. But if you're mistreated, even though you're doing right, so Christ also was mistreated. And in that you find that reward. The person who has sinned is the one that has used you in that particular fashion. In fact, Amos attacks Israel for a number of things, including selling the poor for a pair of shoes. That's abuse. You could, if a person, if you were a cobbler and Ed owed you for a pair of shoes and you came to collect and Ed couldn't pay for that pair of shoes, you had a couple of choices. You could be nice and extend it, or if you wished, according to the law and according to society, you could take Ed and sell Ed into slavery. And depending on how much he owed you, you could sell his entire family. You could sell his entire family into slavery for that. And so, you know, Amos gets on and says, you sell the poor for a pair of shoes. And he also says there in Amos chapter 2, he says that he attacks not only Israel's sins there, but he includes, and a man and his father go into the same maiden on garments taken in pledge. And this is the word used for a maidservant, a female slave. And here he attacks him because a man and his father abuse a maidservant, and therefore they profane God's holiness. Just because she was a maidservant, but they chose to abuse, and he said, you know, that is a sin. And in fact, those folks, there's a warning that those folks can cry out to God. Even the cultic servants, priests and Levites and others, could bring their laments before God. They were not simply to acquiesce in a divine service or accept without question whatever life brought them. Walter Harrelson, Old Testament scholar, writes, those who had been blessed with wealth or good fortune were to share this blessing with others. If necessary, they were to undergo suffering on behalf of others, recognizing that those who had received much were required to render much service. It is in that context that the picture of the suffering servant of Isaiah is to be placed. Israel is God's servant in the world. In fact, typically within Judaism, when you started talking about the suffering servant, Israel was the servant. Israel is God's servant and is required to uphold the Torah before the nations, even when they are abused. So the servant or the slave does not get to, just because they're abused or wrongly treated, does not get to suddenly say, okay, well, God, I was doing this for you and this didn't go well, so see you and check out. There's no credit in that. The credit is to continue to serve. Continue to serve. And with the eventual idea that God will heal. Yes, Ariel. Right. Right. Well, and not only becoming a missionary like that, you know, talking about going somewhere else, self-giving, you're also giving, it's also family. Yeah, any kind of strong commitment. As we said this morning, even to try and score 10 in the Olympics, it takes suffering and... They do. You know, we had Sharon Strawhorn used to come here every now and then on when she was back from somewhere over in the Far East. She slipped up one time, and I know where she was serving, and may someday go back. But it was one of those places where she couldn't tell people where she was serving because it was a highly Islamic country, and she could be not just castigated. So, well, and that's the therein is the rub, and that's a difficult thing. We really don't want to be slaves, right? We really don't want to be servants because we'd much rather. Right. Oh, I know. Well. Wait a minute. That's what mothers and fathers do, don't they? The ones who don't know him, and sometimes ones who say they do. You know, that whole understanding of giving of self, emptying self. Being the servant of the Lord. Displaying in the face of difficulty. Another thing with Israel, they saw themselves as a suffering servant, generally here in 2 Isaiah. But they were supposed to display before the nations loyalty to God, even when they thought that maybe God was the cause of their suffering. Or God was allowing the suffering. You know, in 2 Isaiah, Isaiah 45:7, I make peace and create evil, I the Lord God do these things. Their understanding was that the only one who could create anything as far reaching as evil had to be God. God's the only creator. So even there, you know, they're wrestling with the question, is it God that's caused this bad stuff to happen? Because Isaiah says right there in 45:7, I make peace and create evil, I the Lord God do these things. So they were struggling and wrestling with this whole idea of, other nations around them, you know, they had a God that created, and they had a God that created evil too. And so they were struggling with this whole idea and this whole thing of suffering. And especially suffering unjustly. And the servant of the Lord here in this part of Isaiah is one who is to display fidelity to God even when they're suffering. And the purpose of that is not necessarily to get me out of suffering, but so that the other nations will marvel at their loyalty and will be drawn to God. That kind of faith that can hold fast in that kind of suffering is to be a marvel and a drawing card. But how many of us really want to suffer? Yeah. Despite being mistreated, doing those kinds of things. And it is that is accepted and honored by God. And the nation was accepted and honored by God for its faithfulness in doing so. But worshipers were servants. Regardless of the god or goddess that you might serve, worshipers were expected, followers, devotees, were expected to be servants of that god, right? They expected, even today in other world religions, they're expected to keep the shrines up and to do all these other things as well. Individually, yes, but in Israel, it was both individual and collective. That's where we end up with the idea that the suffering servant of God is the nation of Israel, who has been chosen out. So that was the predominant theme in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, of the servant. Israel is God's servant. Suffering comes to Israel. Israel, when they are loyal, to God in the suffering can find redemption and healing, but if they remain disloyal, they only find more pain and more suffering. So the way through the pain and the suffering is more loyalty and more commitment to God, pouring oneself out to God, saying, I want to be even more of a servant for you. And in that, then, we find the healing. But here in chapter 53, who has believed what we've heard, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. In other words, he really wasn't much to look at. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering or a man of sorrow, and acquainted with infirmity or grief. And as one from whom others hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him of no account. Well, how many times, and as I said, Israel, we say, well, how did Israel see themselves as that? That's an individual. No, Israel collectively saw themselves as that because in the face of other nations, they were despised. They were abused. They weren't the big flashy group with all the gold and the kings and the chariots and all this kind of stuff. They were the despised people. Nothing much. That's true. And, you know, here we've got this. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases. Yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned to our own ways, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that before its shears is silent. So he did not open his mouth. By perversion of justice he was taken away. Who could have imagined his future? You know, all of these descriptions, it's no wonder that in Jesus, and especially in Jesus' suffering and in the crucifixion, that the New Testament writers look back at this and say, wait a minute, here is the one. It's not the collective. Here is the one. Old Testament writer C.R. North states, what's most important is what the servant was to do. Suffering is the great purifier when it is accepted without bitterness. That's the key. Accepting without bitterness. And that's very hard to do. Is it not, Ariel? I know it is for me. The uniqueness of the servant lies in this. He not only encountered and accepted suffering in the course of his work. In the final phase, suffering became the means whereby he accomplished his work and was effective in the salvation of others. He made himself an offering for sin. This is vicarious suffering, but it is not crude substitution. But when Christ came and served himself to this, the sublimest utterance of prophecy occurs. Whoever was the original of the servant, none except Christ, was ever its fulfillment. End quote. In other words, here we find he accepts it without bitterness. Yes, there were questions. Jesus said in the garden, if there's any other way. And yes, on the cross, why? My God, why? And yet there was not bitterness in all of that. In fact, even on the cross, in the midst of the suffering, Jesus reached out to others, even asking God to forgive them. He not only encountered suffering, though, and accepted it as part of his work, the suffering became the means whereby his work was accomplished. And that was part of what the writer of Hebrews does. We talked this morning a little bit about that perfection. Through obedience, even obedience to suffering. The Philippian Christ hymn in Philippians 2, 5 through 11 also speaks of that in the New Testament. People are astonished at all of this. And that's the whole point with Israel, but then with Jesus himself. People are astonished. What the suffering servant did would help God's plan come to pass. In exile, God's people thought he was silent. God forgot us. But what happens is God works through his servant. his servant Israel. And then ultimately, when their hopes were dashed time and time again, Trent Butler writes, and I quote, "Finally, one lonely Galilean took upon himself the image of the suffering servant and followed its calling even to the cross. Through the one name, Jesus, all the people of the world have been given the chance to unload their sins and find a new way of life because of his servitude." That is, because of his being the doulos, the slave, the obedient one to God. And so, all of these things, crushed for our iniquities, punishment on us, he was despised, he was rejected, he was cut off from the land of the living. Why? Stricken for our transgressions, not his own. Not his own. And yet, in verse 11, out of his anguish, he shall see light, he shall find satisfaction through his knowledge. The righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Because he was willing to take upon himself the sins as a servant, as a slave par excellence, to be obedient all the way unto death, he has made redemption or salvation available for many. And so when we think of the servant of the Lord, and we think of this whole understanding with Jesus as such, he's the servant of the Lord, he's the one who suffered transgressions, he's the one who was slave to obedience for us, and yet without bitterness. But then when we turn around and say, okay, what does that mean for us, we who are followers? What does it mean? If we're going to follow the pioneer, it means something we don't necessarily want to do, right? If we live through the suffering and are loyal to God without bitterness, there is a key. Doesn't mean we don't ask questions. Doesn't mean we don't wonder. Doesn't mean sometimes we get so mad we go outside and throw 3 dozen eggs at a tree rather than hit it and break our hand. I was told one time I should have done that. I was on the phone. I was at chapel. I was on the phone with my mother. And she said something and I got mad and turned around. I didn't hit the wall. I hit a 2-inch steel door. That hand was that big. And about 30 seconds, I learned real quick. Would have been much better off to have thrown the eggs at a tree. In fact, somebody told me, "Look, you should have just gone out and bought 3 dozen eggs and thrown them at a tree." But yes, that's the difficult thing. That's right, Ariel. But yet Jesus in Luke, actually I was going to use a couple of examples from Al for you, from 2 Maccabees and 4 Maccabees. About being willing to suffer, even and the 7 brothers who suffered death rather than give in. But looking at the time, we'll move on to Luke chapter 9. So what does that mean? Well, in Luke 9:23-25, "Then he said to them all, if any want to become my followers," that is to become, it's a process once again. It's not that we jump on the bandwagon and say, "Hey, here I am, it's all done." No, it's a process. Become my followers. Step by step by step by step. "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it. What does it profit them if they gain the whole world but lose or forfeit?" And the word here is suke, soul. And my translation says themselves, meaning themselves as in all of the person. By the way, Luke is the one who adds daily. Matthew, in the Greek text, it doesn't say take up your cross daily. It just says take up your cross. But Luke adds to it daily. It's a commitment. And the interesting thing is these terms, come after me, follow me, be my disciple. All of these things really mean the same thing. Saving one's self. Suke. by doing this. The entire self, the whole person. And the parallel, losing one's soul is the equivalent of denying self. To become a follower, one must renounce normal family ties. And even the human expectation of a totally self-directed life. When someone is a slave, who directs their life? The master. It doesn't necessarily mean that you will abandon your family. But if the case presents itself, the choice between abandoning family or abandoning your master, the choice there is you must be ready, willing, and do abandon family. There are folks who do that today. There are folks who convert in particular from Islam to other traditions, whether it's Judaism, but even more importantly for us, to Christianity, whose families, as far as they're concerned, they're dead. And they know that from strict, you know, real strict Islamic families. They know that. In fact, there's some of them that will have a personal jihad placed against them. A jihad, which really means struggle or striving. You can have a jihad within yourself, that is struggling with yourself to try and be what God wants you to be. You can have a jihad against nation, or you can have a jihad against individuals. And there are families who will sometimes, if someone converts, and they know when they're going to convert that this is going to be the reaction of the family. And yet the choice is, do I follow what I'm finding true in Jesus of Nazareth as Messiah, or do I continue with Islam and with family, and they give up family to do that, you know, they know.
Sometimes when a person gets in that mode, they get into the tribe incidences where they think they're doing the great thing, so to speak, or something like that, and really aren't accomplishing anything except, abandoning something else that they should be doing.
Well, and yet, if in their being, they're psuche, whether we call that soul or psyche or entire being, if they are totally convinced that it is God who's brought them to that point, then they've got a decision to make. By abandoning that and following after God in Jesus and seeking to be a follower, become a follower, and live that kind of life, only God knows for sure at the end. But Jesus indicates here, that's you got to be willing to take up that cross. Now, sometimes we do. Sometimes people do, and they rationalize themselves into things or talk themselves into things. Of course, I always say you get in trouble when you argue with yourself and lose the argument. That's what we're, that happens. And there are some who convert, who convert to Judaism, or who convert, any conversion of a Muslim to another faith is seen as worthy of death. And families will sometimes, there have been folks who put contracts out on family members. They want them dead. And it's just like the guy last fall, there was a guy whose sister has converted to Christianity and has moved to the United States. And he is over here looking for his sister. He was interviewed. If he finds his sister, they're going to take her back and she will be stoned to death by their family in their village. And he said, because she has abandoned Allah, therefore she's an infidel and that needs to happen. So he's just as committed that way. But there are people who do that, and there are families who have mock funerals for. They'll walk around with it. They'll carry a beer through the streets crying and have a picture of the person that's converted to something else and left. And they're dead to them at that point in time. Take up your cross, though, it was not just a metaphor for Jesus. It was not just a metaphor in his day because people were constantly doing that. But Luke's addition of the word daily shows the cross had become a metaphor for a life of self-denial, ready to face death. And those who do, Jesus said, will save their psuche, their soul, their very being. And who will truly follow then? He says, those who are willing to take up this cross. Now, typically, you know, people say, well, so-and-so, there's this real bad health issue. That boy, they sure have a cross to bear. No. The cross is something that you end up taking upon yourself here. Jesus took the cross upon himself. He knew what he was facing when he did that. And so to be followers, then it's a life of self-denial. We don't like that because we like to get. But it's a life that, you know, it doesn't happen all at once. We become followers. Well, that means a little bit here and a little bit here and a little bit here. Nope, I slipped back two steps, but another step, half step, half step. Which takes a lifetime to accomplish as well. But Jesus says here, those who want to save their lives are going to lose it. But those who are willing to give up their life for my sake and the sake of the kingdom, then they will find it. It's really kind of, you know, Albert Schweitzer, who not only was a medical doctor, but Albert Schweitzer was a theologian. And in a book that he wrote, and this one was long enough to go to where my paperback copy only cost $5.95. That's been a while. But in The Quest of the Historical Jesus, he says, because it is thus preoccupied with the general, the universal, modern theology is determined to find its world escape, its world accepting ethic in the teaching of Jesus. But therein sometimes lies its weakness. For the world affirms itself automatically. The modern spirit cannot but affirm it. But why on that account abolish the conflict between modern life with the world affirming spirit, which inspires it as a whole, and the world negating spirit of Jesus? He's talking about here. Jesus says, it's not the world that you ought to be following. You negate that and follow me, which means that you're going to face suffering, etc. Why spare the spirit of the individual man its appointed task of fighting its way through the world negation of Jesus, contending with him at every step over the value of material and intellectual goods, a conflict in which it may never rest? For the general, for the institutions of society, the rule is affirmation of the world in conscious opposition to the view of Jesus, on the ground that the world itself has affirmed itself. In other words, the view of the world is, forget Jesus and the suffering and all this other kind of stuff. Let's affirm that we're all wonderful and great and all this kind of stuff. And yet he ends his book by saying, the names in which men express their recognition of him as such Messiah, Son of Man, Son of God, have become for us historical parables. He comes to us as one unknown, without a name. As of old, by the lakeside, he came to those men who knew him not. He speaks to us the same word, follow thou me, and sets us to tasks which he has to fulfill for our time. He commands, and to those who obey him, whether they be wise or simple, he will reveal himself in the toils, the conflicts, the sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship. And as an ineffable mystery, they shall learn in their own experience who he is. And that is a part of being a doulos to Christ, to God in Christ. That's a part of this whole thing of becoming a disciple. We have all kinds of ideas, some of them well-based, some of them not so much, as to who Jesus is, what Jesus expects. But Schweitzer, as brilliant as he was, Schweitzer ends his book on the quest of the historical Jesus by saying, what we have to do is really jettison a lot of the ideas that the world throws at us and follow him, listening and commanding. And then when we do so, we may just find him in those sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship and as an ineffable mystery they shall learn in their own experience who he is. Jesus was a suffering servant. Sometimes in our own sufferings, that's where we find out who he truly is. And it's in that instance that there's the opportunity for us to find out that he's greater than anyone that we thought he might be. Because so often we get caught up in what the world's idea is, or even what the world's idea of Jesus is. And what he expects. And so as a suffering servant here, Jesus is the only one that fulfilled that ideal of the suffering servant of God. Israel thought and yet that they could, but then didn't. But Jesus is the only one that fulfilled it completely. Our task, if we are to be his followers, is to deny self, not follow all the things of the world on the broad path. Started to say the Broadway, but then I thought we'd have to go, they say the neon lights are bright. But the broad path, but to deny self, take the narrow path and follow him daily, not just Sunday and Wednesday, but even on Thursday night.
I'd like to say, be as good as he was, though.
No. Well, no, and there is a danger, and there's a danger in saying, oh, well, I never can measure up, and boy, I really feel bad, so why even bother? And then we go on, and we lose our psuche, our being, as opposed to, okay, well, it's out there. Sure, I will never measure up this side of the grave, but that also means I've always got something more to go after in taking up the cross daily. I think there are a lot of times where we do, but I also think that sometimes God allows portions of suffering to come our way, which it's not that God sends them there, but allows them to occur to kind of get our attention and say, let's rethink this a little bit. There were many prophets who suffered, and there were false prophets that suffered as well. But I think that there is generally a difficulty any time the church becomes too blessed by and in the state. When the two get too close together, therein is, in my opinion, that and a dollar get you a drink machine. And that there is the state, the government. Anytime the church gets too involved and becomes the preferred status quo, that's when we have to really watch out. Throughout history, and not just within Christianity, but in other religions, world religions, when the religion and the civil authorities, the government became too close, it ended up most times being a disaster. For both. Which includes Christianity as a state religion. I think maybe where you're going, or where I would presume, is, and I would say that any time the religious establishment gets to the point where it's the one that is trying to legislate morality and make the laws, that's also a problem. Islam is a religion. Judaism is a religion. But we find many instances, even where Judaism involved in civil affairs too much, ended up creating some difficulties for the people as well. I think that, so much for theocracies. But we probably need to, don't have enough time to jump into that tonight. Well, and it's only, no, wait a minute, it got changed. No. But, okay, Ed. Well, there's
people who are doing beheading and everything else in the name of Allah versus those who are more docile and everything else.
Well,
do they have the same belief?
They're a lot of the same basics, but different people approach the Quran different ways and proof texts and pull things out, just like Christians do with the Bible and that kind of thing. But Islam, you've got the majority of Muslims are Sunni, and it was at one point in time the Sunnis were the more moderate, but then again Saddam was a Sunni.
Do the more peaceful ones not claim the more warlike?
That depends. It depends on what's going on, where it is, and why. And there are militant sects in every country in the world where there is Islam. There are more peaceful. And if you really want to get to the peaceful ones, you go to the smallest group, who are the Sufis. And they're the whirling dervish meditation kinds of folks. There are all kinds of offshoots. Even within Sunni and Shia, there are all kinds of other offshoots within those groups as well. But then again, the United States government recognizes over 300 religions and denominations for tax purposes. So talk about splinters and boxes of toothpicks and things. I think we have to, but we have to be careful about any religious tradition carte blanche. This is this, this is this, this is this, because there are good folks in every and there, and there are bad folks as well. So, but in the midst of all of that, when the opportunity comes and the suffering arises, it's fidelity and loyalty to God that helps us to become.
No, we have that. And not to the stream, we talk about this Islam, whatever. We have had this in the kingdom among the Baptist churches.
We've got. There are persons in a Baptist church that started out of this Baptist church that won't come here because of our women deacons and other things. And there are, you know, so it, yeah, we get that all over the place in various denominations within Christianity. So, but then again, if there was ever a perfect church, probably none of us would be in it. At least I wouldn't. As a colleague of mine said years ago, I've been looking for the perfect church. So far I hadn't found it, but if I did, there wouldn't be any people in it. Oh yeah, the disciples got to arguing and fussing and pushing and shoving and all that kind of stuff. And even though it doesn't record everything, I'll almost guarantee you, if we go back in time and look, there'd probably more than one time among those 12 that a fist flew through the air. Well, God bless you. Go in peace. Good night.